Welcome back, everyone, to The Movie Palace, a new podcast taking a look at the films of old Hollywood. I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and I'm joined once again by none other than Clara Cook. Hi, Clara.
Hi, Carl.
Had a good week since we last spoke. How's it going?
Yeah, it's been a good week. It's nice and sunny and summery here in London.
The week's flown by. I don't know where the time's gone. So, as we sort of teased last week, we're here to discuss John Ford's 1939 Western, a seminal Western, I think, for the genre, Stagecoach, aren't we? And I'm really looking forward to it, Clara. Hopefully you are too.
Yeah. This is a good film. This is an interesting film to talk about too.
Totally. But before we get to this film specifically, let's touch a bit more on Westerns then, because I think last week we said, you know, I said I was really into them when I first got into old films. You said, I think, that you were really into them to begin with as well. So, I don't know. What is it about the genre that has such an appeal, do you think?
Well, it's several things. It's this idea that a lot of Westerns are centered on people going out into the unknown. You know, going out into a wilderness, a lawless wilderness, where there isn't either much civilization or society, or civilization and society is sort of rudimentary and I would say dangerous. There's this idea of carving something out in this wilderness, this sort of sense of adventure. It's a real sense of adventure. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what you're going to encounter. There's often a sort of solitary, tough male character who, I guess, has his own kind of code of conduct, his own sort of morality. Rules don't really apply to him. So there's this kind of, I would say, the very anti-establishment Westerns, but at the same time, kind of keeping sort of an established Western viewpoint, but at the same time, they're also kind of anti-establishment. And there's a lot of potential for excitement, for adventure, and also violence. And
yeah,
violence in movies is exciting. I hate to say that as a pacifist, but still, it is actually quite exciting.
No, it's one of those uncomfortable truths we have to wrestle with, isn't it, I suppose. I think the way I see it now, and this is not the way I would have seen it when I was watching these Westerns as a teenager, but the way I see it now is, you know, the Western is such a great vehicle for, like, exploring, like, American national identity, you know, and from all sorts of perspectives, you know, countercultural, authoritarian, reactionary, whatever it might be. But I think when I was younger, though, it was what you just said, though, about excitement and adventure. It was really like the iconography of the genre that appealed to me. If you imagine, I don't know how far up north you've ventured, Clara, but, you know, in the north of England, you know, kind of a working class background like I've got, you know, seeing the American West on screen, you know, some of these big Technicolor adventures and stuff, it's just kind of like a window into another world. So I guess that's kind of how I saw it. Maybe I'm kind of romanticizing that slightly, you know, looking back now. Anyway, let's turn our thoughts to Stagecoach. Obviously not a colour film. A film directed by John Ford, starring Claire Trevor and John Wayne. And I saw this film, this was one of the first old films I saw, I think. But how would you, like, tee this film up for someone who's never seen it, do you think? How would you kind of, like, summarise it, like, in a nutshell?
So I would say, if you've ever seen a sort of disaster movie in which a bunch of complete strangers and completely different personalities are thrown together, this is that, but in a moving stagecoach out in the West. So it is actually kind of, I think a lot of people would find this cliched and sort of stereotypical initially, because there's been a lot of films that have sort of been based on that trope since then. A lot of modern films, a whole bunch of strangers thrown together in a lifeboat, a whole bunch of strangers thrown together in a lift, a whole bunch of strangers thrown together in a spaceship. But when it was originally made, I don't think it was quite as much as the cliche as it might seem now.
Yeah, totally. And, like, I'm wondering why then. So why did you suggest this one to talk about on the podcast? And, like, and do you have this kind of personal history with the film? Was this one your dad sat you down with and watched, or?
Yeah, so I first saw it as a child, and And watching it now as an adult was interesting, because I had quite a different reaction to it now as an adult as I did as a child. And also, it's that famous shot of John Wayne where the camera moves in so closely and so quick that it actually, like, the cameraman can't keep the focus.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then it kind of zooms in on his face. And my father was quite a fan of John Wayne movies. I'm not sure he was a fan of John Wayne himself, but he was a fan of the kind of, like, sort of John Wayne type of cowboy. And this harks back to my father's childhood, where he was really obsessed with Westerns and he used to play cowboys and Indians in the back garden, you know.
Yep.
And so, and I grew up in a very different situation. I didn't grow up in America. I didn't grow up with the woods behind my house. I grew up in a very urban street in London. So for me, this is like wide open spaces, big landscapes, you know, the excitement of just getting on your horse and riding as far as you can in a day. And I think that really appealed to me.
Yeah, and like on this viewing, well, actually, I've watched it twice yesterday, right? Because the first time I watched it in the afternoon, like it was fine, but the kids were running around playing and stuff, so I couldn't really concentrate. So then I was the last one up. Everyone had gone to bed last night, so I watched it again, you know. And if anything, this film, I've probably seen it 4 or 5 times in total, but honestly, it continues to rise in my estimation, you know. I think as a portrait of like human behaviour, and like class division and social structure, that kind of thing, it's actually surprisingly quite deft, you know. But it's the great thing is it's a cracking Western in all sorts of other ways too, you know. Like this journey narrative's really like compelling, you know. There's the revenge element, I think, works pretty damn well too. And just, you know, lots of great performances to discuss too, aren't there?
Yeah, the acting is really good, especially Claire Trevor, I think, and John Wayne. But also yeah. all the other sort of supplemental, the other little characters in the stagecoach, they all play their parts expertly well.
Yeah, totally. And let's come back. We'll do a quick rundown of all of them, I think, because each of them deserves their moment in the spotlight. So before we do, though, before we get to the narrative and everything, let's talk a little bit about John Ford, because fascinating figure, of course. I think at this time, Ford was pretty well established. He'd made lots of Westerns, but it had been actually a little while since he'd last made one. I think since about 1926 or so. And more recently, he'd done, you know, a range of stuff, action films, comedies, melodramas. And I think the interesting thing is at this point, he's kind of seen as like a guarantee of quality, you know. So he's kind of courted by like, you know, great producers like David O. Selznick and so on. And Selznick wasn't really keen on the idea of Stagecoach. And if it was to be done, he didn't want Claire Trevor and John Wayne. He wanted Gary Cooper and Marlena Dietrich to be in it. So that deal kind of fell apart, I think. But let's talk a bit about Ford, because you mentioned him, didn't you, last week when we were talking about like favourite filmmakers and stuff. He was in your top three, I think. So what is it about him that's so great in your view?
So one of the things that I love about him is the way that he shoots certain scenes. So like the fast moving shot straight up into John Wayne's face in Stagecoach, and in another one of his films, The Searchers, which is another favorite film of mine, there's lots of shots there, like people framed by doorways, which is always just really pleasing to the eye. The sort of close-up of a character's face as the character looks like in at a different distant point, you know, the character's looking sort of beyond the camera. It's very sort of kind of almost kind of like epic, and it is very Western. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that he has all these little attention to detail, all these little characters, he puts a lot of people in his films that are from different communities and from different social backgrounds, and he always has like a little character somewhere that has a few lines. It isn't really kind of essential to the plot, but is there for color. So, and I think he does make an effort to include different ethnic backgrounds, although obviously it's problematic in Westerns, but we'll talk about that later, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess we will. And kind of a mixed record on that front, I would say, for Ford. But oh no, I think he's brilliant, actually, because I think there's a real lyrical quality to his direction, you know. And there are some scenes in Stagecoach, like the dinner table scene, where it's maybe like not so obtrusive the way he kind of sets the scene up, but if you actually like stop and study it, it's really kind of pleasingly done, really kind of breathtaking, but in like a low-key way, you know. I think in terms of what Ford was after with Stagecoach is, to some extent, he's trying to like reinvigorate or reinvent the genre here. And you've got stuff in Stagecoach like, you know, you've got the use of distinguished character actors adding a bit of class to proceedings. You've got these extra elements like the love story and the melodrama with the birth of the baby and so on. It's kind of an attempt, I think, to like broaden the genre's appeal, because what it means is like the publicity materials could emphasize like those elements in an attempt to draw like a large audience, you know. So I think on the one hand, maybe at first glance, this looks like quite a simple film, but actually, I think it's deceptively complex. I don't know if you'd agree or not.
Yeah, it is deceptively complex, and I think that's down to the fact that initially, each individual character in the stagecoach seems like a very simple character. You know, one's a blustering fool, one's, you know, one's a banker, one's a this. But actually, as the film goes on, you realise they actually are more complex. They're not as simple as they first appear. And they have good sides and bad sides to them, like real people do.
Yeah, and there's like, you know, first appearances aren't everything in Stagecoach. You know, you've got these ostensibly like respectable characters who, when, you know, when the action gets going, their morality definitely gets called into question in some instances, I think. So let's talk a bit more about the characters, I guess. I mean, unlike a lot of Westerns, we don't get a specific date, I think, for the setting of this film, but it takes place when, like, Geronimo and his followers are in, you know, they've got this kind of cat and mouse game going on with the US Army. So I think, if I've got my history right, that kind of pegs it at sort of the early to mid-1880s. So that's kind of when we are, where we are. What I really like about this film is how skillfully, in the early running, it kind of establishes all of these characters. And let's come on to John Wayne later, because he kind of enters the film later, doesn't he? But let's start with, like, the leading lady here, you know, the top-billed star, Claire Trevor. And I'll tell you what, actually, before we talk about her performance, we can do a little bit of a game. Do you know how much she was paid for this film?
No.
Would you want to venture a guess?
Am I going to take it that she was paid a lot less than everyone else, or was she paid a lot more? Is this going to be like one of those situations where I'm going to feel annoyed?
I don't think you'll feel annoyed. I don't think so.
I mean, and nowadays it was probably not much compared to nowadays, right? But yeah. At the time, like, I don't know. I mean, what was she paid like a couple hundred dollars or $1,000 or something?
Bit better than that. A bit better.
Oh, really?
So she was paid $15,000 apparently for this film.
Well, that's pretty decent.
And my source for this is there's a BFI film classics book on Stagecoach, which kind of lists this. I'm not sure where they got it from, but she was the most highly paid, actually, and she was the biggest star at the time. So she's paid $15,000. John Wayne's paid less, but how much less? How much do you reckon John Wayne would have got for this film?
So, what, like $10,000 maybe?
No, much less. He got paid $3,700 for this film.
Oh, that's shocking. I mean, she's in it slightly more than him, but not much more.
It's funny, isn't it? Just we think of it as, like we say, we think of it, or I do at least, you know, in my mind's eye. Wayne is the first one I think of, but it's this film that kind of sets him off and running properly as a star. Some of the other actors, I don't have the figures here, but, you know, quite a few of them were paid more than Wayne, actually. But let's go back to Claire Trevor then. So, yeah, what did you make of her performance, I guess?
I thought it was good. I think,
yeah,
I mean,
me too.
It's not over the top. Do you know what I mean? And that's what I liked about it. It's quite subtle. She seems like a very warm person in the film. She's got this sort of beautiful smile, which she sort of uses in scenes without any dialogue. She kind of uses her facial expressions a lot. And she's just excellent at acting uncomfortable. You know, when she's being treated basically with discrimination or prejudice by the other people in the stagecoach, you can kind of sort of really feel her, like, sort of shame and feeling of being uncomfortable, because it's very much expressed in her body language and her face. And I think that the dialogue that she has been given, she delivers it really well, very convincingly.
Yeah, I think she's really good, actually. And like you mentioned, like, she does have a warm, like, quality, but she's also got like a hard-edged aspect to her as well that I kind of appreciated. And I also thought there was like a real palpable chemistry between her and Wayne. Like in a lot of those close-ups when they're just kind of like looking at each other, it just felt authentic to me. And I think it's no surprise that they'd be kind of teamed up again in at least a couple of other subsequent films, you know. What about this issue of like women in the Western then? Because, I mean, it often seems to me they're kind of either... Often they represent kind of a way out, you know, or they like signify like an alternative to violence. And I guess that's one of the things about the Western genre is maybe it's getting better over time, but I don't know, how rounded are the possibility, or how numerous are the possibilities for great roles for women in Westerns? I don't know.
I think it's always going to be hard for there to be well-rounded, interesting roles for women in Westerns, primarily because the Western genre is centered on the idea that might is right, that physical might, that violence is the way to resolve things, that physical strength is the way to survive. And I'm not saying that women can't be physically strong or they can't be violent. As we've seen in more recent modern day Westerns, they have plenty of you know, shots of women shooting guns and stuff. But in a world where physical brutality reigns supreme, women are naturally less strong. Well, they're not as physically strong as men, and biologically. And so in a situation like that, most women, especially women, pioneer women, or women who are sort of Victorian women, you know, with like Lucy, with sort of Victorian morals and Victorian behavior, or even women like Dallas, who have these, she's a very strong person. She's got this kind of womanly, kind of earthy kind of sort of strength to her. Even her, there's only a certain amount of opportunities for women in that situation because they don't have the physical strength of a man, you know, so they don't have the ability to overpower or in violence or in physical strength. I mean, in reality, a huge percentage of women in the West would have been doing manual physical labor. If you think about it, if it was farms, the idea that Hollywood presents is that there is this farmer or rancher or cowboy, and then he's the one doing the physical work and the women are back in the house cooking and cleaning. But women would have done a huge percentage of housework and also a huge percentage of farm work as well. So they would have been physically strong. But when it comes to, I mean, we see this in modern day, like in Westworld, you know, I mean, I guess they've changed it now. But in the first series, a lot of the violence was men perpetrating the violence against women because physically they couldn't fight back as much. So, and that's the issue with Westerns. Westerns are lawless. Like, the law of civilization doesn't reach that genre.
Yeah, or it's like, or it's, you know, it's nominally in place, but it's not applied or whatever. So, I mean, I think there are quite a few exceptions, but I think generally that's right. You know, I think there are stars like Barbara Stanwyck who had some good roles in Westerns, for example. But, you know, I think Claire Trevor acquits herself very well here. And I couldn't remember. It'd been a few years since Stagecoach. And like I say, I mainly think of Wayne, but so I was kind of pleasantly surprised by how much I was into her performance. I'll tell you what then, let's quickly run down like the other people on the Stagecoach before we get to Wayne. So I'll tell you what, if I give you like the character's name, just give me a very quick, like, your very quick thoughts on them, I guess. So let's start with Buck, played by Andy Devine. So he's the guy who drives the coach. And he's got this like distinctive like honking voice, isn't he? Which almost doesn't seem to come from his body. I really like him.
Yeah, I think as far as I could tell, I think Andy Devine used that voice in multiple films. That was like his trademark, you know, this big body and this kind of like high pitched voice that comes out of this big body. He's like a standard character in Westerns, isn't he? He's like the sort of innocent, bumbling fool.
Yeah.
But kind-hearted. He's like the opposite of the cowboy, you know, the wise sort of like experienced cowboy. He's this sort of sweet guy, but you see that kind of character in so many Westerns, and actually in a lot of films of this era, actually.
Yeah, and he's quite a reliable source of like comic relief here, where he's saying, should he charge the baby half fare and that kind of thing. So I liked him, definitely. What about Curly, the marshal, played by George Bancroft? Comes good at the end, I suppose.
Yeah, he comes good. I think Curly is another sort of standard Western type of character, isn't he? He's sort of like the world-weary sheriff who's trying to uphold law in essentially a very lawless place. Like, he can't prevent Ringo from shooting Luke Plummer, and he can't take Ringo back to prison. So he can't prevent a murder or uphold the law of Lordsburg or Tonto.
Yeah.
He's pretty ineffectual, actually.
He's pretty, yeah. Now you mention it, he's, yeah. Come on, Curly. Right, what about Hatfield, played by John Carradine? Had previously been in the Virginia Regiment or something like that. You know, the one who wants to go on the coach to protect Lucy.
Yeah, so Hatfield is Hatfield is a kind of character that I don't think I see much in Westerns. And actually, Hatfield kind of intrigued me. For one thing, his motives regarding Lucy are not very clear. You know, he's essentially taking an unnecessary journey into danger, and he's not really going to get anything out of it because she's very devoted to her husband. But also, he's this representation of... So there's echoes in this movie of post-Civil War tension, isn't there? And Definitely. he's a representation of, like, the Southern gentleman who's kind of fallen from grace after the South lost in the Civil War. And he's the only one that dies at the end of it.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if it maybe doesn't play to us today. We maybe don't perceive it, but it's the reason he is so keen on protecting Lucy that, you know, somebody like Lucy is almost the kind of like Southern aristocracy, you know, with his military pedigree in her family and so on. And I think, was Hatfield kind of ashamed at the way his life had kind of developed? I don't know.
Yeah, because he's the son of a judge and he doesn't mention the judge until he's dying.
Yeah.
So he's obviously not revealed that he is this... And he also, doesn't he have like a cup that has a crest on it from like a Southern manor, which is obviously his home, and he tries to just sort of kind of hide that as well. So he is, yeah, he's like this shameful leftover result of sort of Southern nobility. And he dies because there's no place for him in the Democratic West, the new America, which is going to apparently be more egalitarian, supposedly. not for the Indians, but you know.
Yeah, there's definitely limits to it. Right, Lucy Mallory, played by Louise Platt, quite a delicate character, heavily pregnant, of course, we soon discover. I mean, how did you find all this melodrama with the baby? There were some moments that made you chuckle, I understand, is that right?
Yeah, so in almost any movie where somebody gives birth, especially an old movie, but they do it in movies now as well. Someone rushes out and says, you know, I need boiled water. I need lots of boiled water. And I've never been able to figure out why they need so much boiled water. I mean, they don't boil water in hospital, do they? When you give birth now, so
I've attended two childbirths, and I don't recall. I definitely didn't ask anybody for hot water. it must be to sterilize stuff, mustn't it? That's the only reason I can think of, but they didn't really have much equipment to sterilize as far as I could see, so I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's just a line. They have to make it out that this is something urgent and people are going to help, so I think they have to put something in. But yeah, so Lucy isn't a bad person, but she sort of represents this sort of uptight kind of snobby Victorian morality. And although she actually shows more consideration for Dallas once Dallas helps her with childbirth, she's still, even at the end, she's still like, they're not going to be friends, and she has no desire to really make a close connection with Dallas because of the fact that Dallas is essentially a tainted woman.
Let's just rattle through these last few then, because I'm conscious that the John Wayne fans will be getting impatient. So Samuel Peacock, was it Haycock? I'm not sure. Peacock, played by a guy, actually he's played by an actor called Donald Meek, which is appropriate because he's actually a very meek person, isn't he? You know, and there's all this comic business about people continually getting his name wrong. But, you know, I like this guy.
And he's actually kind of a kind person as well, even though he's sort of a little bit of a ridiculous character. I feel like he's there to be a foil for the other characters, to sort of contrast their personalities.
Yep, and we had the clearly villainous figure of the banker, Boo, played by... the character's name is Gatewood, isn't it? And what's interesting is he has this kind of speech where he's talking about, like, hands off the banks and everything, you know. So I think that would have had, like, a contemporary resonance for audiences at the time. You know, this is in Franklin D. Roosevelt's America. And that's just one example, I suppose, of the way Westerns are these kind of vehicles for kind of dealing with contemporary issues, you know. An effective villain, though, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, he's a really unkind character. And he's immoral, and he's racist.
Yeah, he's not got much going for him, has he, really? And then finally, I think, unless I missed anyone, I don't think I have, but we've got Doc Boone, played by Thomas Mitchell, who actually won an Oscar for the role. And this idea of, like, drunken revelry is quite common, I think, in Ford's films, you know. And here, some of it's, you know, comic business, but there are also elements of pathos and so on, aren't they? But I really appreciated his performance. He was particularly good, I thought.
Yeah, he's actually a good doctor. I think his alcoholism is kind of sad, really, especially when he has one more drink before he leaves the town at the beginning and his hands are shaking. He's desperate. It's a real addiction, but he's actually a good doctor and he's a good person. And he's the person that Dallas confides in. And, you know, the fact that the two of them are run out of town together you know, the tart with a heart and the drunk with a soul is an example of the fact that you shouldn't judge people by, you know, their failings or the circumstances they find themselves in.
Yeah, and it's one of the main like virtues of the film, I think, is like so well done. The way Ford sets up this blurring of the lines, really, between the honourable and the dishonourable. So, you know, Doc Boone, he's a doctor, so on the one hand, he should have a decent social status. But like you say, it's kind of his character is called into question because of his alcoholism. So I think somebody says at one point he couldn't doctor a horse or something like that, don't they? But like the film's really good at just playing out the way these dynamics kind of shift around, isn't it? It's very well done. Let's talk about the main man, I think, John Wayne. So his career kind of had been languishing a bit in the years immediately prior to this. So Stagecoach definitely gives him this big boost. I think what strikes me here is he's really like, I almost want to use the word beautiful in this film. He's very handsome, isn't he? And he's very graceful the way he moves too.
Yeah, and he looks really young, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. And he's about 30, I think, at this time. Something like that, anyway.
But they call him Kid, you know, and it's almost like he is a boy. I think he's supposed to be in his early 20s, and he's supposed to be this sort of young, sort of kind, optimistic, brave man. And I really felt that. I felt that he had this sort of young, kind of fresh look to him, despite the fact that he actually is probably a lot more older.
Let's talk a little bit more about Wayne then, because I think his character here is a great example of, like, I think this happened a lot before the Second World War in Westerns, where the hero would be quite an uncomplicated figure, you know. And I think then there's this influence of World War II and the post-war period, post-war malaise, where Western heroes get more psychologically complex. And you can sort of track it over time through John Wayne, actually, because something like this is a great example of quite a simple, almost innocent, quote-unquote innocent figure. And then if you follow him to films like other Ford films, like She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, where he's more reflective and so on, and ultimately Up to the Searchers, I think, is like the crowning glory, where his characterization there is very complex in my view. You know, you can sort of see the way that the genre changes in terms of its heroes. But here, he's a particularly striking hero. And another thing that's interesting is, like, at the film's end, you know, you sort of think of the Western hero as being, like, alone at the end of the film. So it's quite nice, actually, when they go off together at the end of this film, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you think of the Western hero as being like Shane, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, this kind of lone gunslinger, or this guy this gun for hire going off by himself. And it's a very lonely kind of character. But you're right, in this film, they go off together. It's actually quite refreshing, really.
I mean, do you rate him as an actor? Because I'll be honest, I really do. And I think there's still a bit of debate about this, but I don't know. I think in some of those films, stuff like Red River as well, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, I think that this kind of caricatured view of him that some people have as somebody who just turned up and did John Wayne, I think that kind of sells him a bit short, honestly. I think he's very good here, and I think he continues to get better through the 40s and 50s, is kind of how I'd put it, I think.
I think he uses his body a lot, and I like that. I think he's got a very physical style of acting. It's very naturalistic. It's very easy, but it's very realistic, like type of acting. So, he doesn't seem like a caricature. He seems like a very natural character. He almost seems like a cowboy that's wandered into the film.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Rather than someone who's shown up to act. Unlike, say, for instance, the guy who's playing the banker, it's a different kind of character. But the guy who's playing a banker, it's very much an act. You know, I'm sure there are people like that who are that blustering and that cowardly, but it does feel very much like an act, whereas John Wayne's character, right from that first shot, feels very authentic. He feels like the most naturally authentic person in the entire film, I think. And he's very subtle in his facial expressions. You know, he especially when he's expressing something like shock or disappointment or tenderness, you know, it's like he can even just sort of change the way you think about his character or the scene with just like a small little change in his facial expression. And I think that's acting. I don't think that's, you know, like an accident.
No, I totally agree. I think the idea that he just turns up and, you know, John Wayne is John Wayne from film to film is not right, because I think that even if that were the case, which I don't necessarily accept, but the construct of John Wayne is quite a complex feat in itself, you know.
I also think a lot of that is down to John Ford's direction as well. I mean, there is other bits in the film where just there's a slight change of expression, and that sort of sets the tone. So when the lieutenant is saying goodbye, sort of halfway through the first half of the film, saying goodbye to the stagecoach, and he sort of waves and smiles, and Lucy waves at him, and then as soon as she turns away, his expression from like this sort of friendly smile changes to this frown. And I did not notice that watching it the first time as a kid, but watching it now, there's all sorts of little touches that I noticed that are put in there, I think, by the director.
I mean, in terms of Wayne, I wonder if it's kind of his drawl. I think maybe some modern audiences kind of read it as being a bit like mannered or something, but I don't really see it that way. But I just wonder if there are any like anti-John Wayne viewers out there and you want to let me know why, please do. Please get in touch. I think we should talk a bit about like the casual racism in this film. I mean, I think what stood out to me, I was going into the film thinking that we'd be talking more about the Native American figures, but what I want to start with at least is like the Mexican characters, specifically that guy Chris, you know. Because like on the one hand, he's quite a kind guy, he's very sympathetic in one sense, but I think the way he's presented, you know, he's overweight, he's got this large family, you know, there's all sorts of casual jokes aimed at his wife's expense. It's all very stereotypical, very of that time, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, there's also references, like Buck references his Spanish fiance, and he also says, oh, she's got this huge family and I'm feeding them all, or whatever he says. So that's casual racism in the sense that, you know, the idea that the Mexicans are these huge families that are like, you know, leeching off, I don't know, the Westerners or whatever. Yeah, Chris is a problem. Like, the fact that he cares more about his horse than losing his wife.
Yeah.
You know, that's supposed to be like a joke, but it's also sort of a little like hint that, I don't know, what the Mexicans don't have the same level of emotional depth that like the Westerners do. I don't know. I mean, it sort of felt odd. It didn't sit well with me. And her as well, she's a very typical type of, his wife, his squaw wife or whatever, the sort of native wife. Because obviously at that time, the Mexicans some Mexicans and some, you know, Native American Apache, Native American Indians, I guess, had like allegiances with each other. But she's almost a stereotype too, isn't she? This kind of foreign woman that none of them can understand, who kind of looks at them with suspicion, you know, aiding and abetting the enemy. That felt like a cliche.
Yeah, and she's referred to, I think, in dialogue at one point as a savage, isn't she, too? What about the Native Americans then? Did you have any particular thoughts on those characters?
So when I was younger, I would watch this film and I'd watch it with my parents, and my mum would say, she would always say, like, who are those stuntmen? You know, those Native American stuntmen who... Because it is the same guy, or the same five guys, falling off the same horse again and again and again. And she used to wonder, like, they're so talented at falling off horses and doing all these tricks with horses and riding really fast. And she used to wonder, who are they? And, you know, when you watch it, you do wonder, who are these amazing people who are, you know, doing these stunts? So that's what I was focusing on when I was younger. But this time round, as an adult, and I suppose... as someone who has become, you know, can we say the word woke? I don't know, maybe slightly more woke than I was before. I would hope. I felt that this was a bad treatment of, like, the Indigenous Americans. And I think I really actually struggled a little bit then thinking about the whole genre. I started to think, well, actually, I wonder how, you know, Native American Indian communities feel about the whole Western genre, because the whole Western genre is essentially told from a white American Western point of view, isn't it? I mean,
typically, yeah.
And a lot of these old films, the stuff that we're seeing as pioneering and adventurous and exciting, I would imagine, is from a different point of view, is seen as colonizing and encroaching on people's territory and, you know, leading to the degradation and the suffering of other cultures and societies. So I was like, oh no, it's going to be hard to enjoy it in the same way. I think the main issue is the shot of the Cheyenne scout right in the beginning. He has none of the Indians have any dialogue. He has no dialogue. They just zoom in onto him and he's very impassive. And although he's kind of got this impassive face, there's obviously threat behind it. He doesn't like the Apaches, but he doesn't really like his army colleagues either, does he?
Well, no, that's it, because ostensibly he's this kind of ally at that point anyway. But like you say, he's definitely visually portrayed as quite menacing. Totally. I think Ford's an interesting one in that respect, because I'm not sure how much, you know, his treatment of Native American characters stands up. I think he's purportedly, he makes a film quite late in his career called, I think it's Cheyenne Autumn, which is kind of an attempt to reckon with some of these things, which actually I haven't seen, but it sounds fascinating. So that might be one to dig out one day.
Mm.
That's probably early 60s or something like that. But in terms of, you mentioned the stuntmen. So let's talk a little bit about that chase sequence, I guess. Because that's definitely one of the highlights of the film for me. I think it's actually pretty marvellous stuff. Like you say, incredible stunt work. So you've got this figure, Yakima Kanut, who he does the big stunts in this film that you'd sort of think of. So the one where he drops down between the horses and the stagecoach runs over him, you know, that's a pretty jaw-dropping stunt, isn't it? It's all done in one shot as well.
Yeah, it is jaw-dropping. I also wondered how they managed to do some of this stuff without the horses being injured.
Mm.
But there is a shot where a horse falls down and then gets straight back up again. So, I mean, I wondered if the horses were trained in the same way or in a different, you know, and if the stuntmen worked closely with the horses. The whole thing is really kind of, like, it kind of takes your breath away a little bit. You're like, oh my God, you know, wondering if anyone was actually injured while making this film.
Yeah, I'll tell you what's funny about Stagecoach is that Yakima Kanut, he's like the stuntman for so many characters that effectively what you're watching at points is him chasing himself, you know.
Really? That's amazing.
It is, isn't it? And there's kind of a logical flaw in that sequence, which is why don't they just shoot the horses, you know, then the whole thing would be over in 2 seconds. But you just don't really think about that. You get swept up in it, don't you?
There is something interesting about this film, which I think John Ford actually addresses later in The Searchers, which, and you find this again and again in lots of Westerns, is that the fact that they ride their horses at such speed and with such intensity, and for a short chase sequence, you probably could ride a horse at that speed and that intensity, but the actual stagecoach is riding at such speed for so long that those horses would be dead. They would have killed those horses. So, and in The Searchers, there is a scene where John Wayne has to stop riding his horse to let his horse rest. And the other person he's with doesn't stop. And that person's horse dies. And
that's right.
And there's a situation where John Wayne needs to get to a place very, very urgently. But he has to wait, even though it's killing him, because he knows if he continues to ride his horse at this speed, the horse will die and he will have no horse. So I always found this very funny. I think my mother pointed this out to me. She's like, there's no way they could ride that fast for that long because all the horses would be dead. But I always find it funny that even in the early parts of the movie, when they're not being chased by anybody, they're like riding at breakneck speed. You know, and I think in most cases, real stagecoach journeys would have taken forever because the horses were just walking.
Yeah, well, actually, that leads me on to something else I thought was quite funny, which is that we've got this kind of imaginary geography at play because, like, you know, parts of the film are shot in Monument Valley on the Utah-Arizona border, I think that is, you know, parts in California. And apparently, if you know Monument Valley well, you know, you can sort of see the way those locations are used. And they're not actually making much progress, apparently, on their stagecoach journey. You know?
They're just going past the same thing again.
Well, it's the same in The Searchers, where I think at one point you've got this, like, years-long voyage with Ethan and I'm blanking on his name right now, but the Jeffrey Hunter character. And apparently they don't move very far in that film either, but it doesn't really matter unless you kind of obsess about these things because, like, the landscape's so kind of striking, I guess. And I don't know, there's just something great about it, isn't it? Because you've got this, like, unimaginably vast open spaces and, like, you've got this human drama that's kind of confined to this small stagecoach. And just something about that contrast works like a treat, doesn't it?
It is almost like they're in a lifeboat in a vast sea, except that they're in a stagecoach in a vast sort of like desert-like landscape, right? So it's that idea of being squashed together in close quarters in this big hostile world, really.
Something very powerful about that.
Yeah.
Let's move things on a little bit then. We'll kind of come to the end. So, I mean, the shootout is kind of as old as the Western itself, I think, even older than cinema, because you'd have like paintings of Western towns with shootouts on the street. So it predates like the movies. And we get this shootout here. It's a pretty good example of the type, I think. You know, the build up to it's effective. We don't really see what happens.
Yeah, and there's a lot of sort of trademark John Ford shots, you know, people framed in doorways, silhouettes of people, the fact that the three brothers kind of walk in unison together towards Ringo. So it is very atmospheric. I think for me, it felt... I always struggle with this part of the film because it feels like there's this particular type of pace throughout most of the film, like this like rapidly moving stagecoach. And then suddenly the stagecoach arrives, everybody's kind of hauled off it. And then there's this like little extra bit at the end, almost like an epilogue.
It is like an epilogue, yeah.
That, I think, in terms of pace, that doesn't work so well for me, but it's a minor complaint.
Well, it gets us to that ending, which I like. You know, the last scene with Dallas and the Ringo Kid and Curly sending them off and everything. Rousing stuff, I think.
Yeah, and Doc also saying that they've sort of... I can't remember what he says now. He says something like, you know, they've been saved from, like, the blessings of civilization or something. So it's this idea that actually maybe the wilderness is a freer, more exciting place to live than the civilized, stuffy, Victorian civilized, like, morality, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I just wanted to go for a few kind of off-screen things in a minute. But, I mean, before we do, did you have any more thoughts on the film itself you wanted to bring up, Clara?
Just that Ringo is essentially going to commit murder. And I thought it was interesting that, you're right, they have this very sort of simple, good hero who's actually going off to do something very bad. But it's almost like everyone kind of needs him and wants him to do it. And also they make Luke obviously a villain. He's wearing a black hat, you know, and in Western terminology, that means he's a bastard. So
yeah.
He's almost like he deserves to die. And the fact that Doc sort of stands up to him and everything as well. Right. And he's sort of mean to Doc and he's unpleasant. And so I thought that was interesting in our modern day morality in London. I'm not going to go into modern day morality around the world, but in London, you know, it's especially with the sort of laws that we have here about guns and stuff, it doesn't sit well, you know. But in the movie, it's clear that he has to avenge his brother and father's death.
Yeah, and it sounds like, you know, he went to prison on their say so. They kind of ganged up against him is kind of what they imply.
Yeah,
you know. And, like, from the beginning, like, Buck is like, oh, he broke out of prison, good for him, you know. So, yeah, you're right, there's not much doubt about whose side we're supposed to be on at any point, is there, in the film. Let's talk, I mean, I think, yeah, this one really stands up for me as an effective, like, economical piece of storytelling, I suppose. And I'm sure it'll be a couple of years or so before I watch it again. But, I mean, how old is it at this point? 1939, my maths, it's coming up on its 80th anniversary, is it? Yeah.
Well, I guess you could say the anniversary of the start of World War II.
I suppose that's marginally more significant. Yeah, you're right.
But it is interesting that, I mean, I completely didn't realize it when I was watching the film. I was like, oh my god, this was the year that the war started in Europe, which, you know, obviously America didn't come into the war at that point. But
no, yeah, and the film I think was made through 1938, I think, you know. But like, in terms of the history, 1939, arguably this is like Hollywood's greatest year, you know, because there's lots of good stuff released this year. It's The Wizard of Oz, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Goodbye Mr. Chips, Only Angels Have Wings, and lots more. If you look on Wikipedia or whatever, it's just film after film after film that you'd like happily sit down and spend an afternoon watching, you know, today. I think at the Oscars that year, Gone with the Wind was the big winner. Stagecoach picked up a couple. I think Thomas Mitchell, like we already said, Best Supporting Actor, and Best Score it got as well. So it had a bit of success. It was strongly reviewed. Did well at the box office, I think. Orson Welles said, apparently, that he learned to be a director by watching Ford. And watching Stagecoach, specifically, he said he watched it over 40 times, you know. So I think the Western genre at this point is kind of having a bit of an upturn anyway. You know, there's quite a lot of stuff in production when Stagecoach comes out. But obviously the success of this didn't hurt the genre, I don't think. And it goes on to be arguably the big genre of the 1940s, I guess. But anyway, I guess that's it for Stagecoach, Clara. So big, big thanks from me for joining me for these first two episodes of the podcast. Hopefully, it won't be too long till we hear from you again. I guess my people will have to talk to your people or something, you know. But, anyway, big thanks.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And I know people will have followed you on Twitter and stuff last week, but if they, you know, if they unimaginably didn't for some reason, how can they rectify that?
So you can find me on Twitter at Clara Jean MC, and please head over and, you know, tweet us and tweet me and tell me what you thought of Stagecoach if you decided to watch it along with us.
Yeah, definitely. It'd be good to hear from some people who maybe aren't as keen on the film as us as well. It'd be good to hear from anyone, you know, a range of diverse views would be nice to hear. Anyway, I think next time on the podcast, I'm going to be having a bit of a leisurely chat with none other than one of my friends, Nathan Drake, someone Clara knows as well, who is about to relaunch, or it's coming soon anyway, I'm not sure exactly when, but the Close Encounters of the Film Kind podcast is Nathan's venture. So he'll be here next week, talking a bit about that, talking a bit about old films, and then we're going to get into King Kong is the plan. All right, so in the meantime, listeners, you can find me on Twitter at csweeney758, or follow the podcast, please, at Movie Palace Pod, or search for us on Facebook, type in Movie Palace, you should find our page there. I hope you can join me next time, listeners, when the curtain rises at the Movie Palace.